with us right now to discuss some of the biggest stories around in national politics at the moment. We welcome Dale Husband and Liam Hare. Kia ora korua, welcome both.
Kia ora. Ata mare, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Liam. Kia ora, tēnā koe, Liam. Kia ora, Catherine. It's lovely to be on your program again. Ngā mihi nui, kā koe, tato ene, kia ora.
Ngā mihi nui and welcome. Thank you very much. And what I'm just going to do is just quickly try and find your disclosures, each of you, your introductions.
Well, I like curry, if that helps at all.
Dale is a long-time broadcaster and Radio Wātea presenter. Where he hosts a current affairs program currently as part of a long and distinguished career. Liam Hare is a Palmerston North lawyer, political commentator and a member of the National Party. And distinguished career, Liam, you can have that too. You can.
Well, I'm only 38, so I would say I like to say it's not too long
okay,
yet.
Okay, so sort of middling.
Still got time to go.
All right. Look, let's begin with the focus that continues on not just the job losses, obviously, for 3,000-plus individuals and counting in the public sector. That's all the pain, dislocation, financial stress and everything else that accompanies redundancies. And that's one matter. But the matter we're going to look on today is just this discussion about what is frontline and what the government is promising, which is that services will improve. Also, the latest coming from the finance minister, if I heard correctly, was that there will be more funding for frontline services in the budget. How are you reading this, Dale, and particularly with those two big announcements last week, Ministry of Education and also Oranga Tamariki, more than 1,000 jobs announced to be going in one day?
Well, I remain unconvinced, to be honest. Catherine, it's very difficult to handle or believe that they're going to be improved frontline services with the slashing of this amount of workers in kaimahi. And, you know, it's really distressing that the constant news we're getting is of job losses, is of tightening the belts, and to say 6 and 7% across the board, I just can't fathom how there can be a suggestion that frontline services are going to be improved. This week I've heard constant references to bureaucratic molasses, which is a term that Tamaportaka and also Shane Jones have been using. But, you know, we should, as a nation, feel for those people who are being marched down the road. What's going to happen to them? And yes, you might say, oh, well, we've over-catered by hiring too many public servants. But each of these families are going to be in very stressful situations at the moment. My fear is that most will uproot and just move across the Tasman. It's always been a lure, so we need the best and brightest to stay here. And so a suggestion that the frontline staff's going to be improved with these huge slashing of mahi just doesn't sit with me. I can't see how anyone can shout that from the rooftops and frankly don't believe it.
Liam, we've had this discussion before about who goes and who decides who goes. And it was interesting in some of what was reported out of the Ministry of Education staff last week. It was the regional office staff, special needs staff and other support staff. And they're all going, head office ain't sacking itself. This is the risk with doing it the way that the government has chosen to do it, right?
Yeah, that is exactly correct. So the government, is trying to do it in a governance type way, right? Where you have the chief executive in charge of implementing government policy and the government tells you what the result is and you leave the operational decisions, including who's there and who isn't there, to the people who are there to manage the department as if they don't have a vested interest themselves. And so, I think it's inevitable that if the government takes a more hands-off approach to directing where the cuts are made, that this is going to happen. And what will happen is, we've already seen it a couple of times, is that the government will find itself on the back foot and it has to belatedly get involved at a more operational level about directing where those cuts need to be. Now, on the subject of the cuts themselves, I think we're always going to contextualize this in terms of the enormous growth. I mean, we're only winding the public sector back in terms of numbers by about 6 or 7 months. And I think the government's got to be very, very careful not to get into too cute of an argument with the public about what frontline services really means. I think frontline services has a very specific, plain and ordinary meaning, which is that there are roles that interface and provide services directly to the public. So doctors, nurses, teachers, police officers, social workers, they're all frontline. And I think if the, when the government, if the government tries to move off that to adopt some more, a bit of a more technical or a cuter sort of definition of that, then the public will rightly feel a bit betrayed about it. But I don't think that's happened yet. It might happen, it might come, but we're not quite there yet.
It's also customs officers and others working in these organisations, and as we read about another bird flu making its way around the traps, that's enjoying mammalian hosts more than we would like. We've got the rare sort of advantage of distance on that particular one at the moment, but you need robust systems, or you're going to be spending a lot more than the few percentage points you take off one year's budget. And some of the points that come out of those departments. Is that the cops, the police, excuse me, the police will say this too. The front line, if it ends up doing what someone in the so-called back office is doing now, is impacted. And, you know, if you're talking about a quality of decision-making about who goes and who stays, that's where the government is exposed.
Well, the government's not making those decisions directly, right? And that's the issue. The government's going to get the blame, you know, governments always do, and rightly so. But they have delegated a lot of that responsibility, right, to the management of these departments. And management always tends to see management as being crucial, and so yeah, that is the risk that the government has, right? And so the government may have to get its hands dirty, or get its hands dirtier than it has done, to ensure that that promise of the public is maintained. But
well, they're
look,
not the gurus of everything, though, are they, down in Wellington? Some of them come in with fairly average CVs, to be honest, those decision makers. And politics is about public perception. And at the moment, you've got to think that people are thinking that it's the government who's slashing jobs left, right and centre. We're seeing prices going up at the petrol pumps, at the supermarket checkouts. And frontline staff are already affected. The bobbies, I won't use coppers there, Catherine, the bobbies are saying, no, well, that pay deal is not up to what we need. Nurses, you know, are suffering hugely. I spoke with Kitty Nuku, who you've probably spoken with before, Catherine, from the nurses organisation. I mean, the nurses lining up to go across the Tasman are considerable in numbers. But at the moment, the public perception of what the government is doing is hammering down in every possible area. And we'll talk about some other matters that create that perception as well as we go through our quarterly.
Right. So there's no doubt that those roles are public, that they are frontline services, and that's where the danger is. There is less public sympathy for the managers of managers of managers, and that is where, so far, most of the cuts have happened.
And it took a, and it was grating that the parliamentarians decided that they were worthy of a bit of a financial boost when others are being marched down the road.
I don't know that it is the managers of the managers of the managers, Liam, and that's the situation that stands at the moment. I mean, there's not a lot of clarity about this. We went on the Education Ministry's website, for example, trying to find out where those 500 staff worked. Now there, and I understand they're in a change process and they need to consult in inverted commas and everything else, but we don't actually know the decisions that are being made or on what basis.
We have to wait and see. Cut costs and cut heads, and that is something that actually really does just have to happen, given the enormous growth in the headcount.
I don't know how many of the managers, are in the regions. They tend to be located a little bit closer to where I'm sitting. Anyway, look, let's move on. Another interesting point is the focus come on. This was written by Craig Rennie, the union official, and now on Labor's policy committee, I think, and becoming a significant voice, can I say, within the Labor Party on policy issues. Really trying to throw the focus again back on the government's ability to add the numbers up and to promise more while also promising its tax cut stale. Is this an interesting kind of second front to try and open this debate up on, Dale?
It is. Slash to save to spend. And so at the moment, it's a juggling act. It's playing out publicly, but for most working class New Zealand people, they don't see it in the way that perhaps the finance minister does, evolving. All they are seeing are job cuts and hardship. And I know you take offence to it being described as tax cuts for the rich, Liam, but servicing those who are landlords and trying to lessen their responsibilities, fiscal responsibilities, or to get more money into their coffers doesn't sit well with working class New Zealanders. Ngāi Māori at the moment are shaking their heads in disbelief at the constant barrage that's coming our way. And in our fora, where we discuss Māori current affairs, there's a hell of a lot of nervousness at the moment about the direction that this government is going. It feels at times we're forced to soak it up, but change will be afoot because an unpopular government's not going to get 2-3 terms, is it? So they're skating on pretty thin ice at the moment, the coalition government.
We'll come to that in more detail in a moment, Dale, what you're alluding to. But just back to this issue again, I think we're Craig Rennie and perhaps in time Labor spokespeople will get to, is this age-old argument of whether you can say you're not borrowing for one thing, you're borrowing for something else. And we've been there many, many times, and often in the debate of tax cuts. And in this case, you know, if the savings, in inverted commas, from these job cuts and other approaches don't add up, is that a potential strong line of attack for Labor, or is it just too down in the weeds for most people?
It's a good line of attack, right? I mean, I don't take offence to the idea that it's tax cuts for the rich. What I do take a little bit of umbrage at is the description of tax cuts, especially when we're talking about things like brackets adjustment, as spending, as if, you know, the government declining to take more revenue is the same as the government deciding to spend money on something. And look, you know, I've said it before the election, I've said it before every election. Governments have limited control over, you know, the precise numbers that flow from government actions, decisions. A lot of it depends on the external economy. And the thing is that governments try to get the general settings right, and they just have to leave the rest up to God in some respect. Now, there was actually a poll, a taxpayer union courier poll last week, and 53% of voters still wanted tax cuts, 29% said they didn't. So, you know, it's not just about who you're talking to. You've got to look at the rest of the public, not just the people within your own circle and your own bubble. You know, the government isn't going to be sunk over tax cuts this term. All right, it's probably safe on safe ground. It promised to do it before the election. It got elected, and people still want it to fulfil its promise.
Yeah, the landlord's tax is probably the one that has provided the richest tax for Labor and others, as opposed to the bracket adjustments and the credits.
Yeah, well, on that, there's two things, and this is political analysis. It's not giving an opinion as such, but there might be 80,000 to 90,000 landlords in New Zealand who are National Party voters. They're an important constituency for the National Party, and so the National Party's really got to deliver on that. And the second part is there is a principled case for it, right, which is that there is no reason, real rational reason, to penalise landlords by not allowing them to deduct interest on their investments like every other type of investment. So you've got the combination of a principled reason why, plus it's an important constituency for National. So that's baked in, that's inevitable too.
All right, let's have a look at some of what I think Dale is alluding to at the moment, and this is the real kind of collision course that senior members of the coalition government have set themselves on with the Waitangi Tribunal, and it's unfolding in a rather interesting way. The Prime Minister's sort of having a tut-tut finger wave while overseas at some of what has been said by his coalition partners. Dale, how are you reading what's unfolding here?
Well, the Waitangi Tribunal has been a vehicle that has assisted in Māori empowerment and growth over the past 50-odd years. And so to be as dismissive of it as many politicians have been really hits to the core of many Māori leaders and certainly voters. The standoff that we're witnessing in the High Court today also illustrates this. And Shane Jones has been very, very vocal in his criticism of the tribunal. But as a vehicle to try and address the injustices of yesteryear, well, we don't have an alternative. And until somebody comes up with a decent alternative to try and address the wrongs of yesteryear and the constant collective amnesia that many non-Māori have about how they came to be on the most productive lands, for instance, in this country, we're just not going to get where we need to be, which is as a cohesive and unified nation. We still have unresolved issues, and what's playing out today in the High Court is very important, because the Waitangi Tribunal, at the moment is just trying to address whether the repeal of 7AA affects the treaty standing.
Could you just, let's just get more specific for folk. This is to do with the Minister of Children that the tribunal issued a summons to, and this is to do, just explain a bit more of the detail, please, Dale.
Well, they want to know that the moves by the minister responsible here, Karen Chow, is not detrimental to the position of the treaty. And I think that that's a very important discussion that does need to be clarified. But we are seeing unprecedented criticism of the tribunal in this coalition government. And until we find an alternative replacement that's going to address the horror of yesteryear, then I think that that constant criticism coming from the coalition government, and particularly some members within, is unhelpful and unwarranted.
Liam, what the Crown is mounting is an argument against compelling a minister to give evidence in the Waitangi Tribunal. I'll get you to comment on that. But also what's happened with Minister Jones and also Minister Seymour coming out as a result with some very very strong comments.
Right, so the issue at hand today is whether or not the tribunal can or should summons the minister to give evidence before it. It seems to me, I should disclose that the judge hearing that's my old boss, Andrew Isaac, who's a brilliant mind, and he'll make the right ruling, whatever it is. But it seems to me that, you know, the tribunal does, you know, on its face have the power to do that. The question is really if it's prudent for it to do it or not. And this comes down to the idea of comity between institutions. Look, the tribunal isn't a court. It's not a judicial body. It's a standing sort of a commission of inquiry. But having said that, it's an important institution in our government. It's done really important work throughout the years. It's, you know, it's a vital part of, you know, the New Zealand constitutional framework. But having said that, that doesn't mean it's always above criticism. What we have here, right, is the tribunal really sort of flexing its muscles in a couple of ways. But a key thing I think that needs to be stated is that the tribunal is being speculative. They are launching into an investigation about something that hasn't happened yet. Right, so we have a process for making laws in this country. The minister doesn't make the laws. The minister can introduce legislation into Parliament, and there is a whole process that we have to go through to determine whether or not Parliament adopts that legislation. If that legislation ultimately breaches the treaty, that's something to have an investigation about then. But we have for that reason, when a matter is before Parliament, the tribunal isn't supposed to hear, can't have a hearing about it. And so what they're trying to do is have a hearing in advance to rush the hearing before the government actually has done anything.
Just
right?
Help me with this, because there was a similar argument with the disbandment of the Māori Health Authority, the legislation introduced to doing that, and the tribunal was to have an urgent hearing. An obvious observation is that if you have your hearing after something's done, that is far more complicated to undo it than to argue the case before it is done. Now, with the Māori Health Authority, that was a very, very long-signalled policy. In this instance, just explain to me again about the process, Liam. If not now, when would this happen?
After you don't investigate a breach of something before it's happened.
Uh-huh.
You don't investigate a crime before it's happened. You don't sue someone for breach of contract.
Apply to so-called contemporary claims? Because much of what the tribunal dealt with, of course, for much of its life, were historic claims. But we got to a point some years ago now where increasingly it's contemporary claims that have become its business. And does that change anything at all?
Well, contemporary claims will be the business of the tribunal going forward as historic claims are settled. And it's got an important role there. But let me ask you a question. Why is it that the tribunal doesn't hear things while Parliament is considering them? Why is that there as a policy? Right, because the appropriate forum, right, for political questions is through Parliament. That's why. So, this is a workaround of a principle that has long been part of the framework for this. So it's an attempt to cheat it. And so, look, the tribunal has infringed on its prerogatives, but at the same time, the government's been completely unhelpful with senior members of the coalition government overreacting with very purple language. And so my concern, right, is that we get into the cycle of polarization where each camp polarizes against each other. Everyone needs to take a breather.
It seems to me to be a protest action of sorts with nowhere else to go. People will lodge claims to the Waitangi Tribunal, which we know too, Liam, has only got recommendatory powers. It hasn't got binding powers. I do take your point that it seems to be cart before the horse here. But the damage done by the changing of legislation takes a lot of undoing. And so I think front-footing the situation is another form of challenge and of protest where Māori will be forced to operate in many different spheres, whether it's digitally, by collating a lot of thoughts to challenge towards Parliament, marching to the parliamentary steps. In this case, a challenge to the tribunal who is looking at the case to see how it sits. I don't think there's too much wrong with that.
All right. Now, let's just finish with AUKUS because the Pillar 2 debate has become a very interesting topic as to whether National is moving in a non-partisan way, whether not National necessarily. Of course, the Foreign Minister is Winston Peters. There's perceived to be an enthusiasm, and he comes out and says you're getting ahead of yourselves, but there is perceived to be a bit of an enthusiasm towards possible involvement with AUKUS Pillar 2. Interestingly, this week, Labour had its own kind of powwow over this with prominent speakers, former Prime Minister Helen Clark, who's been very prominent on the subject. When are they going to have to make a decision and actually take a position on this, Liam? Do they need to necessarily when the government's own position is yet to be clear?
They absolutely do not have to. That's the prerogative of being in opposition, right? It's not for them to make the decision. It's for them to scrutinise. And National benefited from that when it was in opposition, and Labour can too. I mean, I think that it would be very wise for Labour to at least maintain some ambiguity on it, because we know from, you know, history that governments are incoming governments are very loath to undo foreign policy initiatives of previous governments. That's why we have the nuclear free legislation so embedded. That's also why we have the membership of the Trans-Pacific Partnership embedded, despite the fact that the Labour Party opposed it in opposition. So I think, you know, this is one of those things where it's not for Labour to make the running on it, but I think Labour should keep its options open going forward so it doesn't have to execute too much of a U-turn when it gets into power.
Dale, your take on it?
Well, it's interesting you say when it gets into power. I don't know. When do you think that's going to be, Liam?
Well, it could be in 2 years, you know. Like, it's, the mood of the country is not great. So,
no,
you know,
it's not.
It could be sooner than you think.
Well, to be honest, personally, and I think, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of Māori, far from it, but I think there's a heck of a nervousness here. We've got our trading partners. I heard Shane the other day referring to our Navy as machine gun mounted kayaks. So pretty dismissive. But there is a nervousness with us tagging into Oz. We remember how Howard lined up alongside Bush. The Aussies have got close because they want nuclear powered submarines. I don't think that's in our sights or goals. And I don't think that as a nation we've investigated the potential for neutrality. Let's face it, geographically we are isolated, and perhaps there is some merit in that, as has been suggested by Te Pāti Māori. It's never got any traction really from the major parties, but it's certainly worth considering. And as the geopolitical state in the Pacific continues to become even murkier by the day, there is a big nervousness about our politicians sidling up too closely with AUKUS and, in fact, with the US of A.
All right. Just let's finish with this Ipsos mood survey. I think you were alluding to it, Liam. Look, in some ways it's not surprising. We had the pandemic. We now got an enormous economic hangover from the pandemic. There's a lot of personal stress on the households at the moment in many ways. What did you make of Ipsos's mood survey, which was pretty stark, wasn't it?
Yeah, completely unsurprised by it, because things aren't great. There's a lot of pain going around. There just really is. You know, I see it in my business. You know, nobody's got any money. It's not a great way to live. And, you know, things are stretched. And so this, you know, this is more than anything the thing that sets the political mood in the country. Now, the government's hardly had a honeymoon, but, you know, it's in a grace period where I think, you know, people don't expect it to have worked wonders. But as the months roll on, you know, some progress is going to be needed. We still have an inflation problem in this country. Things are still tight. And, you know, there's never been a one-term national government. There's never been a less than three-term national government. But they can't take that for granted the way things are at the moment.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe I read a segment where Māori New Zealanders were particularly unhappy. And what is interesting, Dale, is this talk about a divide between ordinary citizens and the political and economic elite. 60% agree with that. 18% neither agree or disagree. 63% saying the political and economic elite don't care about hard-working people. That's two-thirds of people in this survey.
Well, there are a lot of people who are really doing it tough, and I think if you drive through the streets of Manurewa, you get the feeling for it, Catherine. Also, you know, if you're gauging the mood of the nation, there'd be some pretty sombre responses, particularly by Canterbury Crusader and Warriors fans. And they might have sent those forms out to those people, and obviously, you know, they'll be sad as. So that might have contributed to the numbers, do you think?
Just heard a large grain of salt land in your cup of tea, or mine. Thank you both, Dale Husband and Liam Hare. Ngā mihi nui.